Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 213, and Sir George Grey, the Cape Governor, was peering intensely at the Boer Republics to the north. The Free Staters under Boshoff had failed in their mission to drive Moshoeshoe out of the disputed territory south of the Caledon River, and many of the burghers changed their tune when it came to possible amalgamation with the Transvaal. They were now considering this a viable option. Martinus Pretorius had made good progress north of the Vaal, despite the Boers of Lydenburg opposing his overtures for a single large and powerful Boer state. The fragmentary nature of the Voortrekker states was hard to overcome, but it was heartening for those Boers who wanted unification to hear that the Zuidpansbergers were prepared to listen to arguments for cohesion. One of the most strident and convincing voices that emerged was that of Paul Kreer. He was acting on behalf of Pretorius, and the Zuidpansbergers accepted the Grondwet of the Transvaal, the constitution, which the Rustenburgers adopted. The Northern Republics were moving towards some sort of union. By 1858, the tiny Boer Republic of Utrecht in Northern Natal had thrown in their lot with the Lydenburgers. Grey regarded these moves as ominous. The British Empire had experienced a serious jolt when the Indian Mutiny broke out, and now he'd heard the reports of the Boer expedition to Moshoeshoe's Tabo Basu, which had ended in defeat. He'd have to send reinforcements to India and deal with instability on his own frontier at the same time. The Batlapping people had also taken advantage of the Boer assault on the southeastern edge of the Free State into Basutu territory, and the Batlapping did some invading of their own into the Free State from the west. The San and Korana had also broken loose, and Boshoff's commandos were going to be very busy as they rode around the Free State trying to subdue these raiders. The Boers had recognized that beneath the monarchical authority and prestige of Moshoeshoe lay a weakness in the political structure. Chiefs were patriarchs in their own domain and bound to this hierarchy primarily as the guarantor of their local status. But that status was tied directly to access to land and the acquisition of wealth through cattle or other livestock. One of these strategic shifts in the Volksraad was to reach Moshoeshoe's political supporters by offering them autonomous territory. These black statelets would then be part of a broader Boer state, supposedly free from settler and other Basutu raids and harassment. The mark of this land use was through a collective, a group living on the land in a specific geographic space, who provided territorial power for any chief agreeing to join the Boers. As you're going to hear in future episodes, Moshoeshoe's second son, Modapo, would seek an independent state aligned with the Boers. Mopedi Mokachani, Moshoeshoe's half-brother, was another enticed away from the Basutu polity by the late 1860s. By this time, May 1858, the Transvaal sent a commando to assist the Free State in dealing with these raiders, defeating the Batlapping and imposing crushing reparations on the people for having sheltered some of these rebels. The defeat at the hands of the Basutu, however, proved to most Free Staters that they could not survive alone, and they turned on their president, Boshoff. He had written to Sir George Grey and asked for help in dealing with the Basutu king, an act, a grovelling act, asking the very people who'd indirectly driven them out of the Cape, the English, for help. It was a stunning act of weakness, they thought. However, Pretorius and Kreer heard about the change of heart and arrived back in the Free State from the Transvaal before Grey. They suggested a renewed attack on Moshoeshoe. This would be politically risky, because both republics had separate agreements with the British, conventions signed, and their request for a republican union would be denied. If you recall, the Sand River Convention of 1852 recognized independence of the Transvaal, and the Bloemfontein Convention of 1854 recognized independence of the Free State as separate entities. There was a quid pro quo built in. The British would stay away as long as the Boer states remained stable and separate. They needed to negotiate a new status quo with Grey, as well as what exactly this new Boer state would do and how the conventions would be affected. Grey was better informed about Mashweshwe and realized that the British government was mostly to blame for the anarchy along the frontier between the Free State and the Basutu by abandoning the Orange River's sovereignty without an agreed boundary. The Cape Argus also began to publish a series of articles penned by Joseph Orpen, the Irishman land surveyor I mentioned a few episodes back. He had been dead set against the British abandoning the sovereignty and then had become a burgher and a member of the Free State Volksraad. It was he who had written the constitution upon which the young republic was based. He is also famous, by the way, for founding the town of Kroonstad. Orpen resigned from the Volksraad in disgust when the members seemed unable or unwilling to stop Free State citizens from seizing sand and African children to use as apprentices slash slaves, and Grey read the Argus reports about these acts with horror. Grey then rejected Bulsorf's allegations that the Free State burghers had suffered massive losses, because he'd spoken to former Smithfield Landdrost John Burnett, and that man had scoffed at what he saw as exaggerations of cattle loss. And when the short, sharp war broke out between the Boers and the Basutu, Grey proclaimed the British were now neutral. He was vacillating between the two, and when the Free State at first seemed to be winning the war, he complained that the conventions should have banned the sale of firearms to the Boer republics. Then, when he heard of the Boers' loss to Mashweshwe, he was fearful about the frontier. Grey concluded once and for all that the division of all the white South African communities into separate polities had destroyed their capacity to deal with African chiefs. But he also opposed the idea of Boer states leading some sort of unification. Even more alarming was the news that the two main Boer republics might unite. In his eyes, this would threaten the stability still further, and more importantly, threaten the British colonies of the Cape and Natal and British Kaferia. So he offered to mediate between the Boers and the Basutu, with some provisos. If the Boers went ahead with their unification, he warned that the conventions they had signed would fall away. This could open them up for more interference from London. Pretorius of the Transvaal was the most alarmed about that. He didn't want to lose his people's independence, and in particular, their access to firearms and gunpowder, by just unifying with the Free Staters, who had already caused him grief anyway. It was time, said Pretorius, for the Free Staters to do a deal with Mashweshwe. The first outreach didn't go too well. Bolsof sent an exploratory letter to Mashweshwe suggesting a rapprochement, but the Basutu king was in no mood. He denounced the burghers for burning down the mission stations at Beersheba and Moria and destroying and looting his people's property. "Does their Christianity consist of destroying Christianity?" asked the Basutu king, reasonably enough. Then he taunted the Boers for not standing and fighting at Tabo Busu. But when Grey sent his own letter in June offering to mediate, Mashweshwe changed his tune, said he would suspend all military operations until a peace settlement. The big problem for Mashweshwe at this moment was famine. The Boers had destroyed so much grain and standing crops, his people were now depending on wild plants. The drought had also led to an outbreak of typhoid. Furthermore, the old chief had turned 72, and the friction of the last few years was wearing him out. The Basutu chief was also about to deliver a series of strange missives. Basutu oral tradition has it that Mashweshwe's diplomacy from here on was driven by a struggle ethos, fighting colonialism and creating confusion on purpose. That, however, is not exactly how the story evolved. After the Boers retreated to consider fighting another day, Mashweshwe sent a letter to Grey written by the French missionaries living in Basutoland. The first was sent on 28th May 1858. He castigated the British for allowing the Boers to buy arms and ammunition which they had used against him. But Grey didn't allow the Basutu to arm, hardly an act of a neutral party. A day later, he sent another letter advising Grey that he was finding it difficult to control his warriors to stop them from launching an attack across the Caledon. They wanted to chase the Boers all the way back to their farms. A month later, he sent a third letter, which was a kind of index of infiltration of his land and a comprehensive summary of negotiations over 2 decades. He had met quite an array of British officials: Napier, Maitland, Smith, Warden, Hogan Owen, Cathcart, Clark. He'd met Free State Presidents Hoffman the First and then Bossoff. In his last letter, dated 31st July 1858, he appeared to escalate demands. The main item was the land which was disputed to the southwest of the territory. Meanwhile, Bossoff was facing facts. His army had disintegrated at Tabo Bisu, and he, like Moshoeshoe, blamed the British for leaving the border unresolved. He sent his own letter to Grey, trying to excuse his men for the ransacking of the French mission stations at Beersheba and Moria. On the other side, Bossoff and the Free Staters were dead set against one of Grey's ideas, which was to appoint an impartial commission of inquiry into the whole land question. Who was where and when? That's because the Volksraad had already appointed their own burgher-dominated commission, so no need to have another, they said. Problem was, the Volksraad commission, of course, was not impartial. Time for a face-to-face, thought everyone. It was late August by the time Grey crossed the Orange River and rode to Bloemfontein, then to Tabo Bisu. There, Moshoeshoe gravely agreed to attend a peace conference at Beersheba Mission Station, date 15 September. On that day, the Free State delegation duly arrived, led by young Dutch lawyer H.A.L. Hammelbach. They waited in vain. Moshoeshoe stayed away, sending a note that his half-brother Lesotho and seven councillors were going to represent the Basotho instead. That was a slight, but worse was the detail in the letter that said that half-brother Lesotho and the seven councillors were not authorized to make any commitments in the name of the king. Grey was furious. How could anything be agreed, he wondered. Then went ahead with the peace talks anyway. Here was the first example of Moshoeshoe's diplomatic misstep. In the absence of the respected king, the Boers whipped out their Free State Commission land findings. They showed Grey their new draft treaty respecting the Warden Line, and then flashed depositions from travellers who claimed that when they first visited the Caledon Valley in the 1820s and 1830s, there were no Basotho, only scattered bands of San and Khoisan, Corona Raiders. That, of course, was because of the effect of the Ifitlani that we've heard about. But all was not totally lost. Moshoeshoe had told Grey he'd be available at the next meeting to be held at Moria, which he regarded as a safer spot, closer to Tabo Bisu, just in case the British pulled a fast one and tried to grab him. He had a place to escape. At the Moria gathering, Moshoeshoe withdrew his claim to the entire disputed land and agreed to at least talk about the Boers' draft treaty. After some days of haggling, Moshoeshoe signed the document, which consented to a new boundary running through the disputed zone, about halfway between the Maitland line and the Warden line. It's the next move that's created controversy. Having signed the initial document, Moshoeshoe left granting powers of negotiation to Lesotho and Mokwai to complete the fine-tuning and went home. Grey took this document to Aliwal North, where he met the Boers, who signed off on the new border on the 23rd of September. Just to make sure everyone was clear about where that was, Grey returned to the disputed area with his land surveyor and put down beacons to mark the territorial boundary. Present at the beacon placing were Hammelbach and T.V. Fouve of the Free State, as well as Lesotho and Mokai of the Basotho. Moshoeshoe was nowhere to be seen. Some have suggested that he was already showing signs of a sickness, which could be true. Instead of displaying his weakness, he'd feigned good health, then moved himself physically out of view. Things were a bit confusing. When Mokwai headed back to Tabo Bisu with copies of the treaty, Moshoeshoe sent them back to Aliwal North without signing. The Aliwal North civil commissioner was John Burnett, and he then hurried back across the Caledon and up the famous mountain, meeting Moshoeshoe at Tabo Bisu, and convinced the king to sign the treaty on the 15th of October 1858. The Treaty of Aliwal North identified the boundary of Lesotho as far west as Jammerbach Drift on the Caledon River, the same line established by Warden in 1849. Then it drew a new line linking the Caledon south to the Orange River, halfway between the Warden and Maitland lines. Importantly, what this treaty did was make the land correspond with allegiance. The previous higgledy-piggledy nature of people and allegiance was sorted out. If you remember, Harry Smith's annexation proclamation and the Warden lines had led to Basotho living in the Free State being allowed to owe allegiance to Moshoeshoe. Boers living on the other side of the line were allowed to owe allegiance to the Free State. Messy stuff. All Basutu had to withdraw from the west of the line, and all Boer farmers had to withdraw from the east. This was to take place in a short, although unspecified, period of time, and without compensation. The land around Beersheba switched to Boer control, although the mission station's 6,000 acres were identified as missionary land. Basutu were banned from hunting west of the Caledon, and the Boers were banned from hunting inside Basutu land. A major question was Moshoeshoe's brother, Leteri. He'd fought alongside the Boers during the short war, and now had to head back into Basutu territory. Moshoeshoe promised not to punish him. It became apparent to observers that Grey was not exactly operating as the neutral he claimed to be. The humiliation at Beersheba grated him, and the governor was of the opinion that the land west of the Caledon had not been settled by Moshoeshoe before the Boers rolled in. Grey, like other administrators before him, blamed the missionaries for encouraging Moshoeshoe to make what he called extravagant claims about this disputed land. That was a bit of a stretch. The Basutu themselves believed the king actually controlled quite a bit of this disputed territory long before Moshoeshoe's time. They were just driven out during the Vatrani. This is a case of confusing what ownership meant. We must also remember that before Moshoeshoe, there was not a Basutu empire per se. This has muddied the historical waters further. Then Boer negotiator and land speculator T.V. Fouve made the mistake of trying to push Grey further, and the Cape governor eventually blurted out that he had never seen a more unfair man. That makes sense, because Fouve was one of the largest land-holding Boers of the Free State. He was also the resident magistrate and civil commissioner of the Caledon River District, Smithfield. Fouve owned a whopping 29,434 acres of prime grazing land. That's 121 square kilometres of territory. The fact is that Fouve appeared to buy a lot of that land while he was resident magistrate and civil commissioner of the Caledon River District, which flouted the law. H.J. Erasmus has written a brilliant paper on the topic called Land Jobbing by British Officials in the Orange River Sovereignty, 1848 to 1854. And Fouve, like many others in similar positions of power, flouted the law in direct contravention of then-Governor Harry Smith's directive that civil functionaries and military officers were not to purchase land in the sovereignty. Then, why had Moshoeshoe's diplomacy been so haphazard? Some say he was under the sway of the missionaries, but other evidence points to the fact that none of the missionaries had his full confidence. His sweeping claims of his last letter of July 31st were baffling because they were not realistic. Then fiddling about by disappearing during negotiations and refusing his envoys full powers of negotiation, he avoided signing the treaty. All of this made him look weak. When local Commissioner Burnett met the king to finally convince him to sign, the old man was obviously in the throes of a mental torment. Was he being too soft? Was he being too tough? The Basutu were beginning to starve. Yeah, he was signing away the right to hunt west of the Caledon in the midst of a drought, and after a war which had destroyed much of his stored grain. God made the wild beast for everyone, for whites and blacks, Moshoeshoe told Burnett. Aside from this torment, there was another piece of anguish. Moshoeshoe had now signed numerous agreements with many British officials. None had worked out. Yes, he told Burnett. Sir George Grey is the fifth great man who has come here to make matters right between me and the Boers. And such arrangements have always ended by a piece of my country being lost to my people. Historians believe Moshoeshoe's behaviour was partly to improve his standing with his chiefs and his people. It was not subtle, but some would have regarded the action of standing up to a British official as showing some strength. He felt obliged to preserve his authority by not actually seeming to personally be identifiable as the man who'd agreed to give the land away. It didn't work. Internally, his own son, Sikonyana, was going to hive off part of his Basutu nation and try and set up a new kingdom on the headwaters of the Umzimvubu River, overlooking Natal. His other son, Letsi, who was his heir, began to chafe under his father's tenacious control over events. In the south, Pashuti was running rampant around the Badlands, and Murusi had virtually ignored the War of 1858 and was operating in a semi-autonomous way. Back in London, the new Secretary of State had a brainwave. Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton bade Grey report on the possibility of federating the three British colonies in South Africa, the Cape, Natal, and British Kaffraria. Grey was of the same view. That could bolster the British against both the Boers and the Blacks. Furthermore, a fairly large group of land-owning English Free Staters liked the idea of federation. That would force the stingy Cape merchants to share the customs duties of goods landed at their ports with those in distant Free State. In exchange, Grey would allow the Boers to buy field guns and let the Cape burghers ride upland to support their Boer brethren at times of need. We forget it was strictly against the British law of the time for Boers of the Cape to ride on commando north of the Orange. This law was already decades old and was still in force during the Anglo-Boer War of 1899-1902. British Kaffraria could not be annexed to the Cape without an act of the colonial legislature, which was unlikely, but it could be part of a federation of self-governing states along with Natal. Then, perhaps the Free State would join. As you'll hear in future podcasts, that was a bit of pie-in-the-sky thinking. Please rate the series on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about the various episodes. You can email me from there. Until next, Bona Hamora. Thank you.